Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios, East and West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode, 176 of Registry Matters. Larry, another Saturday night. You've not made it to that gorge yet. I thought I sent you that Uber.
You did, but at the last moment, they canceled it when I saw the destination that we were headed to.
Oh, I see. Dang. Well, you know, they didn't refund the money then.
Well, I think they canceled it inside that five-minute restrict, whatever it is. There's a restriction period where if you cancel, you still have to pay a $5 fee.
Dang it. All right. Well, next time I send it, man, make sure they take you.
Okay.
Tell me about what we have going on tonight.
Well, we have a fantastic program. We have a special guest. We're going to be talking about how registration rules apply when you visit other states or when you consider moving to other states. And then we have a submission from a listener who wants to get off the registry in Georgia. We're going to talk about that. He's not with us. We're going to talk about that. And then we did have a listener question from Inside Prism. I guess we should say a reader question that we decided to carry over to next week. And we have some articles and we have a clip of a politician grandstanding. That should be fun.
Excellent. Cool. So I guess we will introduce the guest. We have Dee is joining us from Pennsylvania, and he is a new patron coming in at a very generous level. And I would thank you so very much. And like I said, he's going to have just a whole battery of questions to throw at Larry, and almost like a speed round. Like, am I going to get a bell? You have 1 minute to answer the questions, Larry. Maybe something like that.
That sounds good.
We'll do it that way. All right. Dee, welcome to the Registry Matters program, and thank you for joining us kind of on short notice.
Well, thank you for having me.
Cool. Well, I guess I'll sit back and relax and watch you to duke it out.
So I guess the main question is the whole lifetime travel, like when you look at Florida and California, what is the deal with, like, you know, say 30 years from now, I still go to Florida. Am I still technically supposed to register if I stay there more than 3 days or 2 days? I know you guys always argue what that is, but.
Well, I'd have to know more information. Are you going to be traveling there as a person who's registered or a person who's not registered at the time you do the travel?
After you're off all the registries in your home state after you've passed. I'm in Pennsylvania. It's 10 years, so I'd be off another year here. And then what would be your opinion of my obligation to Florida or California or wherever you had to register for life?
And that's one of those questions I think we batted around just a little bit in pre-show. And truthfully, if you were to call those states and you were to call more than once, you might get different answers from the states. You would run across some people who would tell you, well, if you're no longer a registered offender, you don't have to bother with that. And then you would have someone answer and say, well, if you have a conviction at any point in your life, you have to register because your lifetime here. And it becomes murkier and murkier because, like, for example, California has just started that removal process that's going to be very difficult. But prior to that, California was lifetime. So if you had anything that would be a registrable offense in another state, it would most likely be registrable in California because of the breadth of how inclusive their registry is. So prior to now, they would probably tell you, of course, you would have to register if you were here beyond whatever the time limits are in California for a visitor or a person temporary present. What would they tell you now after people are being removed from the registry? And I do not know if people have actually been removed. I think the process was supposed to start in 2021. I don't know how well it's working, but I don't know what the answer would be. There's sometimes when people ask questions, we don't know the answer to them, and neither do the authorities. No one knows the answer to that question. If you have a lot of paranoia about you and you believe that the hovercraft is on the horizon, you might would consider registering. I can only speak for myself. If I had been discharged from registration, I would be very hesitant to go put myself in jeopardy again, because Florida, if you visit Florida for that 72 hours or that 48 hours, whichever you believe is the requisite number, they will not remove your name from that registry list. So I would be very hesitant to go put my name on that list, knowing it would never be removed.
then would that, once you're on that Florida registry, is that then considered you're on a registry now? So if you move to another state that says if you have to register, no, would you now, well, technically now I have to register again because I'm on this state's registry. Because I know a lot of the states say, well, you have to register, basically you have to follow your state or our state, depending on which one's worse. That's most of the text that I read.
That's actually one of the best questions I've been asked, because those catch-22s do happen. So, for example, if you were to be a non-registered person in Pennsylvania and you were to go to Florida and you were to be worried about the hovercraft and you registered in Florida, and then when you left Florida, in order to close the loop, you would need to report back into the state where you registered. Of course, you have no state to report into. But what if you were out of, say, Wisconsin, where they have a nuance in their law that says if you're moving to Wisconsin or entering Wisconsin from and you're registered in another state, you have to register there. And that happened with an individual who contacted me wanting to know how to get off the registry. He had lived in Nevada working in the casinos, and he did not have to register because of his Wisconsin conviction. When he gets to Nevada to get his gaming card, he had to register, and he decided life on the registry wasn't as glamorous as he'd hoped it would be. And he went back to Wisconsin, and they said, well, you have to register here because you're coming from a state where you're registered. So what if you return to Pennsylvania? And I haven't done the research on this. And what if Pennsylvania said, well, because you're entering from a state where you're registered? I don't think I know the answer to that either, but it is a great question.
Yeah, that was always one of my one fears. If you leave a state that you have a good, because Pennsylvania is a very good state because they ruled that it's a punishment. So if you're prior to 2012, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're kind of locked in there as they can't really change it after the fact now on you.
You're correct. The Menez decision and whatever the other name was, there was a couple of decisions that were very favorable out of the state Supreme Court, and people there have received some relief. But I thought they passed a more benign version of registration, and they were applying that to the people with the older convictions. Is that an error? Did they not do that?
As far as I know, yeah, they changed it. So if you're prior to 2012, you got to follow the old rules. And then after 2012, you had to follow their new rules that now do follow the law, I suppose.
So, well, again, that would be why I gave the answer I gave at first. If I'm not required to register in a state, I'm going to be very, very hesitant to go to another state as a visitor and register. But I can't advise anybody not to do that, because the last thing I want is someone to come back and say, well, Registry Matters said that, but I'm telling you, just speaking for myself, I would be very hesitant to do that.
Hey, Larry, I just want to pause for a moment. I'm seeing chat from a person in Pennsylvania that says they did Muniz, but Lancome versus Whitmire Mayor reversed that, subchapter H, subchapter I, pre and post SORNA. Is that saying that people that were convicted before those dates also then have to register? I'm not clear on what she's asking, but I want to make sure that we're not passing out super bogus information.
Well,
too.
That's what I was thinking too, that they had reimposed registration in a more benign form.
Okay.
So we can bring Teresa in next week or even now if you want to. But yeah, I'm not totally sure that I'm the best to give advice about PA.
Teresa, would you be prepared to if I muted you right now? She may have like 45 grandkids hanging out. Okay, she said sure. All right.
Hey guys, keep quiet there. I'm telling the 45 grandchildren to be quiet for a minute.
Super appreciate it. Hey Teresa, how are you?
I'm okay.
The head person in charge of Pennsylvania over there, correct?
Well, I'm not in charge, thank God. So there were two cases that went before the Supreme Court, Lacombe and Whitmire. They heard them together because they were similar. They both kind of were lined up with Muniz, looking for the same decision as Muniz got. And basically, the Supreme Court reversed it and said that it is not punishment. But subchapters H and I, which we were talking about, the two different schemes, one for those convicted one for those whose offenses are before December 2012 and one after, they're still intact. However, it's pretty disturbing that basically the same court kind of did an about face with Lacombe and Whitmire when looking at munis. So I just wanted to make that clear.
Cool. Thank you. And you've got a lot of noise in the background. Can you mute yourself? I'll leave you unmuted, but if you can mute yourself.
I will mute me.
Awesome. Thank you. Appreciate the clarification, though, too, Teresa.
So, all right. So let's move on because, yeah, I'm not wanting to give any bad advice.
All right. Well, then let's keep going.
The next one's more specific about Maryland itself, and from what I understand, they follow like the federal kind of guidelines, and they have like a reduction at 10 years. And just wondering if you have to file for that 10 years, or that 10 years is automatic because it like states if you didn't commit another crime or another sex offense, if you finished your probation, and if you completed an appropriate sex offender treatment program. Knows how it's automatic or that's some sort of appeal.
My understanding is that you have to file for that. And I tried to have a guest, but she's with a mother who's having issues with mobility and couldn't come on. But my understanding and recollection is you have to file for that. And there's a process. It doesn't go through a court, but it goes through the Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services, or vice versa, Department Correctional Services and Public Safety, whichever it is. You have to file with them, and then they clear that you submit the documentation that you've done that. Well, what confuses me is if you're going from a state where you've already done that, then you would not be handed off to Maryland as a registered person. So why would you want to go register in Maryland so you could go through the effort of trying to get off if you're already off?
I guess that's the question. That's kind of the question around all of these. If you're off in your state, what are your obligations if when you read the details of that state, you should not be on anymore?
Well, I guess, Andy, do you have any idea how many times we've had episodes where people went to the registry office and ended up having to register, and they might have gone the rest of their life without having to register?
Well, there was that guy in North Carolina that went like three times, and they told him no twice, and then the third time, they're like, wait a minute, you haven't been registering? There was that one.
Yeah, well, then there's also the McGuire case in Alabama. We could go on with people who insist that they want to register. I have a firm belief that if you have been dutifully discharged from registration, not if you're seeking to evade registration, but if you've been discharged from registration, if another state discovers you and believes that you would have to register and have an obligation there, that they would notify you of such. I have not been given one example in the years we've been doing this program or the years I've been doing advocacy of a person who had been relieved of a registration obligation and they've been subsequently prosecuted just because law enforcement stumbled upon them. Is it possible? I guess it's possible. But I tend to like to believe that something is more possible when there's been an incident of it happening. So I would believe that if a person had been relieved of registration properly and gotten a letter in Pennsylvania, and they were to be living in another state, and that state felt they should be registered by either someone ratting them out or them having an encounter with law enforcement and a criminal history being pulled or whatever, they would give them a notice of an obligation to register. Now, it puts you in a conundrum if you got a notice of an obligation to register and you really don't want to register because most people can't pick up and leave really quickly. But that would always be in the back of my mind as I would pick up and leave really quickly and go back to where I was.
Well, your twist too is like you said about the guy in Nevada. If, you know, you go there and then you have to register and then you try to go back to your state and then their state's like, well, now you got to register because you got to register there, even though you're only there for a week.
Oh, well, there again, that's why I don't tend to want to surrender myself to registration authorities if I've been dutifully discharged. And I'm emphasizing you have to have papers releasing you, not that you've released yourself but by not complying, but if you've actually been terminated by either a timeout where you've termed out or whether you filed a petition and the court has granted it, if you're actually relieved of your registration obligation. I challenge the audience. I think I've done this before. If you can show me a case where someone who has been relieved of their obligation to register and who was discovered in another state, who got prosecuted, I would like to see it. I've had that challenge open for a long time. I've had the other one. If you can show me a violation of supervision where the petition says this and this only, and don't add things to it. It says that the person showed deception on a polygraph test, and therefore we the state are moving to revoke. Now everybody shows me these petitions, and they always say it shows deception on a polygraph test, and in a post-polygraph interview, the person admitted to X, Y, Z, and A, B, C, and D, and blah, blah, blah. But where you can just show me a petition where it says show deception on polygraph, that's it. I have not been given one yet. You can show me one where a person has been terminated from treatment because they failed a polygraph. I've seen, I think, one or maybe even two of those. But this is an imagined situation. And I can understand having a vivid imagination when you're facing significant penalties. But it would seem like it would be more credible to imagine it if you could find some incidents where it's happened.
To circle back super quick, Larry, Brian in chat says, seems to me if you're off, you're off. Speaking of the registry, how can another state enforce you needing to be on their registry if you're no longer on any registry? Isn't that because the language says something to the effect of if you've been convicted of something, it has nothing to do with whether you ever had to register. You could have had your conviction in 1910 and you're in a state now that says that you will register as of yesterday. And that's why you have to register?
Yes, it's one, like we covered it last week about the automobile, since this is a civil regulatory scheme, each state is able to define the scope, what they consider to be a sexual offender, what, you know, their list of sexual offenses and their dates of coverage and how far back they reach. Like, for example, Alabama, if you're alive and you've been convicted, you're covered. And that's what happened to Mr. McGuire. He had an 89 conviction out of Colorado and he was not covered there, but when he decided to move to his home in Alabama, he decided to go into the office and ask, did he have a registration obligation? And his idea was the same as the listener. Well, since I don't have to register in Colorado, of course I don't have to register in Alabama. And Alabama told him, well, not so fast. You are alive, aren't you? Yes. You did show us conviction papers from Colorado. Yes. This is you, isn't it? Yes. Well, you have an obligation to register here. And if you try to leave without registering, we're going to lock you up. And that's what that whole case that his brother, who's an attorney, took to federal district court, and which is still pending on appeal in the 11th Circuit. As far as I know, there has not been a final decision on the McGuire case. But yes, you can have an obligation in one state expire, and that doesn't stop the other state from imposing it on you because they can define what a covered offender is more broadly than the state that you were convicted in.
And I also want to circle back on that specific thing. Every state is kind of like their own country, and I'm doing like scare quotes on the screen here, that New Mexico has their own rules, their own laws, their own regulations, and California has their own, and Montana, and everyone is their own independent sovereign, and they get to make their own rules as long as they don't breach what the federal stuff would tell them to do. Something along those lines.
Well, I would say not what the federal tells them to do, what the Constitution prohibits them from doing.
There, okay.
Everything that you want to do as a state, you can do as long as the Constitution doesn't preclude it. And that's what people think about this SORNA, because they look at the AWA, the Adam Walsh Act guidelines, and they say, gee, the Adam Walsh guidelines recommend this as a 15-year Tier 1. I said, well, so what? That doesn't preclude your state from declaring it a 25-year or a lifetime. And you got to prove that it's unconstitutional. All the things that you're having to do while you're registered, you've got to prove that it's unconstitutional, else they can have the term as long as they want it to be. And so, yes, that would be correct, as long as the federal recommendations, if those recommendations are implemented in such a way that they impose too many disabilities and restraints, then you have maybe a viable constitutional challenge. But the feds can't tell the states what to do.
Oh, continue on there, Dee.
All right. So my last one's another specific state. But before I say that, I kind of ask what your advice would be to everybody if they are trying to move to a state. Do you think hiring a lawyer in that state who is specifically geared to understand the registry info is even helpful? Or is it everybody's really just going to tell you, yeah, you don't know?
I love that question. I generally do recommend hiring lawyers. It's kind of like, yeah, it's the business I'm in. But I always put the qualifier that the lawyer actually has to know the law that they're giving advice on. And people tend to want to call lawyers that are not really apprised of this issue and the nuances of registration. I've been providing training to attorneys in the state for, I've even forgotten how many years, and it's amazing how many of them don't understand the various nuances of the three versions that we have of registration and the federal interplay, and they believe that there's a federal registry. So I would advise a person to try to seek out competent legal advice if you're planning on moving to another state. What I would be more emphatic on what I would advise you not to do. Don't call the state registry people. I mean, the place where you're going to get the best advice is not from the registry office, because they do not want you to come. I think I remember telling you that thing yourself, Andy, a few years ago when I said they told you the most gloomy scenario because they do not want you to move there.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
So,
but then it calls into question, Larry, that the whole thing about having the family and some kind of support system, that kind of calls that into question. I mean, yeah, we want you to have support, but probably only where you are now. Don't come here to try and get support. It doesn't feel genuine when they do it that way.
That is correct. I had that argument one time with a client, and he said I would be more stable if I were in the state where my family was. I said, yeah, you would be. But that's looking at the global, the greater common good. And that's kind of liberal mumbo jumbo there. I mean, when you talk about the common good, I agree with you. But the people who are running these departments of probation and parole, they're not looking at it from the global good. They're looking at it from what is going to minimize the risk that we have to take here. And having that person come, when you add the compounding effect of how many people come to a state that have no attachments previously, it's just not an enticing position. I have not heard of a state that welcomes people forced to register to their state. I'm not aware of that state. If there is one, it hasn't surfaced to me.
Mm-hmm. All right. D, continue, please, sir.
So then, when you say qualified, because I've done a lot of Googling, I think my wife called about 10 different lawyers and got, I think, 6 different answers. But how would you even go about finding someone qualified that actually knows what they're talking about?
That is a great question, and I wish I had the answer of how you find it. I know that the state advocacy groups, usually they have a few lawyers that they rely on. We do in our state, and I know Florida does, or think Florida does. You know, Gil Shaffnet comes to mind a lot. Georgia was the litigation that we've been doing. We've got working with a guy named Juracek, and he's been doing a lot of work on GPS monitoring. There's usually in the states where there's either an advocate or a full affiliate of the National Association for Rational Sexual Offense Laws. That would be a starting point, but it is tough because too often they're happy to take your money and they really can't help you. The best thing they can do is to tell you if they really don't know what they're doing and not try to sign you up. Of those 10 that of the phone calls that were made, how many of them were willing to take a fee?
Not that many, actually. Only a couple actually wanted any money. Most of them just told you to go to the state basically and ask them. And then a bunch of them said, we're just fine, move there. That was Maryland, by the way, for the 10-year.
So, this is going to be something we'd like to get back to on another episode, because it's fascinating. It's the type of issue that affects either a lot of people right now or potentially a lot of people in the future, because our country is mobile. People move. If you just watch the census numbers come out, watching the population trends, people move, not just because they're looking for a better place to avoid the most difficult registry requirements, but they're also looking for greater economic opportunities. So this is something that keeps coming up, and we can visit this multiple times, and it never gets boring to people.
Because every state is different.
I don't even mind paying somebody to figure out, but it's like, you know, I had the same thing during conviction. I paid a lawyer and then ended up the public defender was 10 times better. So, you know, I don't mind paying for it, but it's unfortunately you don't know who to pay. And obviously, Larry, it's not even their fault, because it's a hard answer to come up with, because it's, you know, like some of the lawyers said too, they said, well, it changes all the time, so it's so hard to even know.
Larry, I might be out of line calling this out, but isn't this an area where you could help us people, the we people, the lay people, figure out if the attorney, because they can blow smoke up our tushies all day long, and we don't know necessarily if they're qualified to represent us, but you would be more qualified to know if they're able to handle the case in XYZ state.
Well, I would think I could certainly offer some help in that regard. Many times attorneys don't like the type of questions I ask them, and I don't do when an attorney tells me that, and I've learned this from trial and error, but when an attorney tells me about how great they are, particularly when they take a case on the front end, when a person's pretrial, and they tell me that you've got nothing to worry about, the first thing I ask them is, how many trials have you done in the last 2 or 3 years? And of course, the answer is zero. I haven't done any trials. And then I ask them, how many cases have you resolved in this particular jurisdiction? Because if you can have an attorney who does wonderful work in one county, and they don't have the same success rate in another county, they don't have the same relationships with the prosecution, they just don't have the same standing at another county, so they might not be able to get a favorable result. So I start asking questions like that, and they tell me that I maybe should go look for another attorney. You know, that's when I was helping, you remember our friend from Georgia that we got hooked up with an attorney that got his conviction overturned a few years ago.
Mm-hmm. I do.
Well, of the half dozen lawyers we visited in the Metro Atlanta area, I was not very popular with a couple of them because of the type of questions I asked. But we got the right lawyer. We got the job done.
Yep. I'm with you on that. Well, I mean, even like my attorney didn't like me. I was asking him questions. He's like, you don't like attorneys very much. I said, I'm just skeptical of the voodoo and magic that I need you. You're a gatekeeper. So I'm asking you questions because I'm about to drop a big dump of money on you. So like, maybe I can ask you questions about how you operate.
Yeah, those were fair questions you were asking.
All right. How much more? I think, are we done here, or do you have more, D?
The last one's just more specific about the Virginia thing. I don't know if you have much information on that, because they have like lifetime and 15, as far as I understand. But you never off the 15. You have to petition the court, and the judge has to release you from the 15. I was wondering. I also wonder about the same thing in Maryland. Is that something you can do before you move to the state or not? You know,
I have never been aware of a person being able to petition for removal from a registry that they're not subject to. And here's why. Okay, when we talk about being overworked and understaffed, that's not necessarily the case. But whether you're overworked or understaffed or not, you don't want to do any extra work. And if a person files a petition, and I receive that petition, and they're not living in my jurisdiction, the first answer I'm going to write down is going to save me a whole lot of work. I'm going to say, this person is not subject to Virginia registration. Therefore, this is not a controversy that's ripe for deciding. You know, this is a hypothetical. They may never be subject to Virginia. So I would write up a 2-paragraph response and ask that the case be dismissed. If I can think of that, they can think of that. The way I read the Virginia law, as we were looking at pre-show, you can actually file a petition for the tier ones or the tier twos. The tier threes are those who have multiple convictions, and it wasn't clear if the multiple convictions within the same case number, if that's considered multiple, or if you have to have two separate cases, but the tier threes or a person with more than one conviction is not eligible to petition. But it said a tier one could petition after 15 years, and it gave that they shall be released if the judge finds that they don't pose a risk to public safety, and a tier two can file after 25 years. My problem with this is that those petitions are not required. It's just like California, just like these states. Under the rigid federal criteria, those people can just ride off into the sunset. Now, you can have a process for that extra 5-year reduction for tier ones that's available. You can have a process to make sure that they meet all those things on the list. But if you just want to if a person wants to stay on the registry for another 5 years, they shouldn't have to file anything for a tier one, because that 5 years is reduced from the 15-year tier one basic obligation. So if you don't want to get treatment and you don't want to go through all the kabuki of filing a petition, they could still just let you ride off into the sunset after 15 years, and they could let the tier twos ride off into the sunset. They don't do that. Why not? I already know the answer to it, but why not? It's a creating work for attorneys is what that is. And it's also making the victim's advocates happy, giving them another chance to come in and bash the person and to say negative things. And it's another obstacle to keep from actually thinning out the registration list, but it's not necessary. It's not required.
Okay. D, anything else?
That's all. I thank you guys very much.
You're welcome. You can't. Do you want to stick around? You're welcome to if you want to chime in, or we can let you go and kick you to the curb and all that.
Sit here and be quiet until I hear something crazy.
Oh, well, we're gonna do Georgia next, so you might find this interesting.
Yeah. If you have any questions that you would like to chime in on, feel free then.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Like Larry said, we're going to move over to this Georgia segment. And I would like to then clarify, because you put this here for me to say about providing legal advice. Yes, but that also applies to the last segment that. And in general, neither of us are attorneys. One of us knows a lot more about law. If you want computer questions answered, that's me. But legal stuff, that's you. Anyway, so we got a question from a new listener, and he's seeking any guidance that may be available for the procedure to file paperwork and subsequently be classified and removed from the registry. I can't afford an attorney in my case, but would like for me and my family to finally be free of the shackles of remaining on the registry. Any guidance you may be able to provide me would be greatly appreciated. So, where do we go from there?
So,
you talked to the person, right?
I did. I talked to him, and I think he has a good chance of getting off the registry.
Okay. And why would those? Why do you think that?
Well, there are a number of reasons. First, he's residing in Georgia, and he was not convicted in Georgia. And that changes the dynamics significantly. And second, he has a victimless crime, and that makes a huge difference as well.
Okay, so my conviction occurred in Georgia, and you're saying this person was not convicted in Georgia but living here. How are we different?
You're different in that you, under Georgia law, you have to file in the county where you were convicted. A person who wasn't convicted in Georgia has the opportunity to file in any one of the 159 counties in that state. And all you have to do is be residing in one of those counties. Now, I'm not advising people, I would never do that, to go shopping in the 159 counties, but I can tell you this, of the 159 counties, there are counties who have a very large approval of those petitions, a very large number that are approved. And there are counties of the 159 who approve virtually none of them. And if I were a person with a non-Georgia conviction, I do not believe I would plop myself into one of those 159 counties that seldom discharges anybody from registration. I just don't think that would be in my best interest to do that.
So no matter where I live in Georgia, so I just remove myself from probation, so it's just easy. I can just kind of pick up and move somewhere in the state without a whole lot of grief and aggravation, but I would still have to return to this county to do any sort of further modifications?
In terms of your registration obligation, you would have to file in your county of conviction. But this person, what made his odds go up, what makes him a very good candidate, of the many things that makes him a good candidate, is that he can file in the county. He happens to be living in Newton County, which is just east of Atlanta. You go through DeKalb and then Rockdale and then Newton, and it's still considered Metro Atlanta. And Newton is a pretty tolerant place. It didn't used to be that way, but Newton has really changed. And the Superior Court judges in Newton County are not nearly as bad as they once were. So he's got 20 years of sobriety since his offense happened. He's got, I think, either 12 to 15 years of non-supervision since his offense happened. And he, as I pointed out earlier, he has a victimless crime. And when I say victimless crime, so the Newton County Superior Court judge, had that been a Newton County conviction and you had a real victim, there would be the risk to that Superior Court judge and to the district attorney. Remember, you filed the petition and you served the district attorney and you served the sheriff. The registration official is the sheriff. So you served these two parties. There would be a chance that that victim would have either connections in the community, or that there would, that would have been a sensationalized case that would just be too hot to touch because it was so bad. But we have a case here where it was a sting in Florida, and the person traveled from another state to Florida to meet a minor. Of course, there was no minor there, just law enforcement. And then that was turned over to the feds, and the feds prosecuted him. And so he has a victimless crime. We don't consider the law enforcement officers to be victims. I mean, they're witnesses, but they're not victims. So he's got a victimless crime. He has nobody connected to Newton County. He has a relatively tolerant county, and he has a DA that would not have any axe to grind with him unless the sheriff has some dirt on him that gives the sheriff angst. So all those things make him a wonderful candidate. It's too bad that he can't afford a lawyer.
Then let's move on to your second point, that he has a victimless crime. Can you explain what a victim, like, why is it such a big deal that it would be a victimless crime in this case?
It's such a big deal because that's where the pressure often comes from on the removal, because these states insist on bringing the victims in. In some cases, it's required by statute. In some cases, they do it by practice because it'll sink your petition. They'll do it even though it's not in statute. In California, it's in the statute, and that's one of the reasons why I say that that's going to make it very difficult. But what would happen in the case of this particular person, there won't be anybody there. The cops are not victims, so they won't be there. But if he'd had a minor who was still living in Newton County, there would be the real possibility that that person, maybe an adult now, would show up and say that I'm traumatized for life because of this. And that puts pressure on both the district attorney and the Superior Court judge. But he's not going to face any of that because his crime is without a victim.
Interesting. And let's go over, we sort of touched on in the previous segment about needing an attorney. This is something that you harp on all the time. Why are you so obsessed that people should not file their own? That's called pro se, P-R-O-S-E. I think that's the Latin term for it.
That is correct. And I'm obsessed about it because the stakes are high. If the registry is as bad as what we say it is, and I take your word for it, it really is that bad. That means the stakes are high to get relief from the registry. And the average person is way over their head when they're attempting to navigate the hurdles. Georgia law provides a process for removal under, anybody in Georgia, it's OCGA 4-21-19, I believe it is. But let's go through the basics. I'm obsessed because the district attorney is the first person you have to notify, and they're going to be your opponent. They're lawyers, right?
Yes.
The sheriff, although many sheriffs, very few are lawyers, they generally have, a department of any size has access to legal advice, either the county attorney, or they may, if it's a large enough department, they may have their own attorney. So you've got people who have legal resources and training and knowledge, which you as an average person do not have. So you're going into a game you do not understand, and you're trying to be removed from the registry, and the judge is the referee, supposed to be neutral. And the judge is not going to help you get through this because the judge is also at risk on removing you from the registry. If you don't do the job right, you sink your ship. And this is a high stakes game. And that's why I'm obsessed, because I want you to win. play the Bear Bryant clip. The reason why I'm obsessed is because
trying to win the game. There, sorry, it took it a second. You're trying to win the game.
That's why I'm obsessed.
But tell me what happens if I call, or this individual calls our DA and goes, "Hi, I would like to get myself removed, and I'm going to take you to court. Can you tell me what you think about me?" What happens in that kind of in that situation?
Well, it would be very bizarre if that conversation actually went down. But that is exactly what needs to happen. But when you call the DA, like this person got angry because he called the DA, they wouldn't give him advice. And I said, well, they're your opponent. They have a conflict of interest. They're going to be in the very case with you that you file, and they're going to be on the other side arguing for the state of Georgia. Therefore, they have an ethical conflict. But assuming that you could find a DA that would talk to you, you need to have a conversation about how they are going to react to the petition. And I stress this because I hate to see you spend $5,000, $7,500 if you have no chance of winning. So it's imperative you know what the DA and the sheriff are going to say. And when you have an attorney, the attorney can have that conversation either in person, at a coffee shop, or by phone. They can have the conversation. Yeah, what I'm going to file on behalf of my client and name the client. And what is your office position going to be? And you need that information. That helps you decide, A, if you want to continue to move forward with your removal process petition, if you're going to actually go forward. And it helps you decide how much more money you want to sink into it, because you may have a DA that says, well, you know, we don't really have any particular angst with your client per se, but our office has a general policy that we object to all of these. But it's not going to be a very vocal objection, but we are going to say that we object. Then that would empower you with information that you don't have. You know that the DA is not going to come in with all guns blazing, but you know the judge, being that the DA is taking an oppositional stance, although it's not a strong oppositional stance, you know that you need to empower the judge. So that tells you need to get a psychosexual evaluation, a current one. And what everybody says is, Larry, you don't understand. I got a treatment in 2004, and I had glowing reviews, and they loved me in therapy. And I said, well, that was 17 years ago. I want to know about now. And so that would tell you that you need to get a current eval, that it's worthwhile to continue with your effort to be removed, but you need to give the judge some additional ammo because the DA is going to be opposed to you. That's why these conversations need to happen.
And what would you recommend as the most critical point in this whole process?
It's imperative that the conversation with the DA's office and the sheriff's office take place, in particular in Georgia, since it's the sheriff that does the registration. The sheriffs have an awful lot of information on you, particularly the aggressive sheriffs that monitor the people closely. They go out and collect intelligence from neighbors, and you think this is totally benign until you file the petition. But if a neighbor, like say you're a single person and you've never been married and you don't have any children, and the sheriff goes out and says, well, you know, we keep an eye on this guy, he's on the registry, and we're just wondering, have you seen anything out of the ordinary? Any kids around? Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, I did. A couple weeks ago, I saw some teenagers hanging out and blah, blah, blah. Well, that goes in their intelligence file about you. All the stuff that neighbors tell them about you can be used against you later when you seek relief from the registry. So therefore, you've got to know what's in the sheriff's file, what they're going to come at you with. If you have a really, really good relationship with the sheriff and they've told you that they would like to see you off the registry, I still have a little bit of dubiosity, but that goes a long way. But if you have any kind of bad experience with your local law enforcement, if they're constantly harassing you and leaving flyers on your door, and it seems like they're being overly aggressive, there's a good chance that they're going to try to hurt you when you file to be removed. You need to know this, unless you just enjoy burning your money, because that's what you're going to do.
But the, so, So let's talk about a retreat option. Is why would you not move forward? Any person with, I mean, shoot, as I mean, my handlers kept asking me, hey, when are you going to try and get off this? And I was like, I don't know that I'm like allowed to. So I wasn't expecting like I like an entitled mentality. Like, I mean, the judge sentenced me to so long. I am expecting to do so long. But so why would someone go, eh, I'm going to not burn my money. I'll wait till something more opportune. Why would someone do that? Why would someone with good sense would not want off the registry?
Well, in terms of wanting off the registry, I would think if you didn't want off the registry, that there would be something wrong with you, that you wouldn't have good sense. The question I'm asking is, even though it would be very rational to want off the registry, as the coach said, we're trying to win this game. And what we want to do is strategically play this game to up our odds of winning the game. Now, if I'm advising a person on strategy, I am not going to advise a person to go into a firing line when there's a hotly contested DA's race. I'm not going to give that DA a chance to pick out my client and in a re-election cycle and come in and say, and if you re-elect me to be the district attorney, I'm going to make sure that this group of people is treated as bad as possible. And a sheriff could do the same thing because they run for election. So you don't want to put yourself in the line of fire unless you have lots of money to burn and you don't mind waiting 2 years to be able to file again, which is what both the state of Virginia and Georgia require, coincidentally, is you have to wait 2 years after you've been denied. So if you could wait 6 months out of an election cycle, if a judge is going to retire, and you've heard that, well, that frees that judge during that last term to do what they want to do. So you say, well, gee.
Like a lame duck session, so to speak?
Yes. So a judge or a DA that's not running for re-election, they have a lot more freedom. You remember there was a president recently named Obama. And,
I've heard of him.
And he had an open mic where he said, after I get re-elected, I'll have more flexibility when negotiating with Putin. Do you remember that?
It hurts things like it, sure.
Yes,
sure.
Yes, he got a lot of criticism for that, but that's the reality of our system. So therefore, I would consider all these things in terms of strategically positioning myself where I would not be walking into a very hostile situation politically. I know this is not the world the way it should be, but it's the way it is. And you file the petition at the wrong time, you might find yourself being vilified. So you need to have an attorney who's somewhat politically savvy, which is not a gift of most attorneys have, unfortunately, but you need to have asked that question. Is this the best time politically to do this? And you can do your own homework. It's not that hard to figure out when political good times and when something's politically good or not so good. And that's what I would tell everybody to try to do the political analysis. Stop thinking that it doesn't matter, because it does. And figure out what the political considerations are and make your decision based on those, because that's the way the system works.
Will in chat said that you said that expression wrong. It's supposed to be, it's not the way it should be, it's the way it is be. You said it, yep. The way it is. Just
he's
wanted
correct.
To make sure that we have that expression right.
he's correct. I haven't said is be lately.
No, you have not. But on this subject, just like it... Why do you have to make everything about politics all the time, Larry?
Why do I do it? Because that's the system we live in, folks. We live in a country that has a political system. We govern ourselves through that system. If I pretended it didn't exist, then I would not be serving you well. I'm telling you that these are considerations. They can be very significant considerations.
The way that I'm framing that, though, is that we have a law in the case of Georgia's 42-whatever-it-is that says that when these conditions are met, you can do these things. But you just described an example where this may not be, maybe you're sort of outside of the margins a little bit, or things may be a little bit more complicated, that you still have to take the politics into consideration. It's not just black and white. It's not just, hey, this is checkmate, you're done. There are other things at play.
That's correct, because we have to elect those district attorneys, and we have to elect those judges in many states. And Georgia's one of the states where the judges are elected. And if you don't think they think about community sensitivity, just ask Judge Persky.
Right. All right. I don't think we have anything else here unless D, you're still there. Do you have anything you want to chime in on? Or Larry, do you have anything else you want to cover before we move this on?
Well, I would like...
I'll take that all as a no.
I would like for the person who made the inquiry to consider really seriously having an attorney. He has an excellent chance, in my view, if everything he told me is true. And he truly can afford it. I looked up enough information about him, and he admitted after I asked him, I said, well, you know, since I know the county and I know where you live, you know, that's not a poverty zone. And, right. And he said, well, I really prefer to spend the money on starting a business. And I said, well, you know what? This may help your business to be a whole lot more successful if you're not on the registry.
Yeah, no kidding. Because we've covered, Will in chat has sent me story after story after story where they're almost getting doxxed. Major newspapers are putting articles in papers talking about this local business person wants to run a cake shop or something like that. And then the people go up all up in arms because they're running a business that perhaps would have children attended. It's not like you're running a bar, let's say, where kids would never be present, but something where kids may be patrons. And this sounds like a bad idea. And then there's almost like a town revolt, and they go out there with pitchforks and torches.
Yep, and that's what I was trying to convey to him, is that he doesn't know the system well enough. That's not what he does for a living. And if you look at that, and I think I said four, it's 42 section, the removal process in Georgia is 42-1-19. But when you look in the highlighted section, such petition shall be served on the district attorney of the jurisdiction where the petition is filed, the sheriff of the county where the petition is filed, and the sheriff of the county where the individual resides. Service on the district attorney and sheriff may be made by mailing a copy. If petition for release is denied, another petition for release shall not be filed within a period of 2 years from the date of the final order of the previous petition. If you've got 2 years to burn, then go ahead and do it, but I strongly urge you not to do it yourself unless you have significant legal training. And I still wouldn't advise you to do it yourself, even if you have significant legal training. I just can't. I can't advise people to do these petitions themselves. And they say, well, I have the right to. I said, yes, you do. You know, if you've got that, I have the right to fix my car.
And just before we close that all out, just, do you think, is there any benefit to doing it per se? Is there any level of sympathy or concession? Maybe that's not the right word, that the court would then provide you of being just Joe Blow off the street, that they're not going to be so formal and harsh on you for not knowing the rules and procedures?
I don't see it that way. I think okay. That they expect you to know the rules when you proceed pro se, in particular at the superior court level. You know, that's a court of general subject matter jurisdiction. It's not a small claim. So it's not a court of limited jurisdiction. They expect you to know what you're doing. And the criteria, the court may issue an order releasing the individual from registration or residency or employment restrictions in whole or in part if the court finds by preponderance of evidence that the individual does not pose a substantial risk of perpetrating any future dangerous sexual offense. That's actually a pretty good standard. The court may release an individual from such requirements or restrictions for a specific period of time. There's no shalls here in Georgia. And I just don't like those odds. I like going in with armed with the information of where the DA is going to be, where the sheriff's going to be, if they have anything that they're going to say about the client. And I want to know if we're going to have victim notification, what the victims are going to say. I'm going to, if this is a crime where there would be a potential of a victim, I'm going to hire an investigator and I'm going to find out what that victim is going to say, because I want it said before we go to court.
And remind me about standards of evidence. Where does preponderance fall on the scales?
That is slightly better than 50%. So more likely than not.
So if the judge feels like you have slightly more than 50-50, a crapshoot, that, or a roll of the roulette wheel, if you feel slightly better than 50-50, then maybe they'll release you.
Yep. And that's the downside. It's the may. If it said the court shall release you, but it says may, the preponderance is the right standard.
Okay.
So that's not an insurmountable.
I can't imagine that there's anything lower. That there's a lower than 50% chance.
so,
All right. I think we are done there. We can move over to this clip. Do you want to set up the clip from the good senator?
Yes, I believe this is something that just basically was predictable. We talked about it on episode 149, and I don't even know how we got to that point, but we were talking about money for dead people, the government paying dead people money. And I said, it's only a matter of time before there will be criticism of the payments that are being made as a result of the stimulus packages. There's been, what, three or four of them now? And I said that there will be the criticism of paying money to dead people. Lo and behold, I came across Senator Kennedy from Louisiana, I believe he's from. So this is not the Kennedy family from Massachusetts, but Senator Kennedy, he had something to say about paying money to dead people.
Boy, golly, I hope my tech works. It worked in pre-show. Here we go with a clip. And it didn't work the way I wanted it to.
For example, we waste $144 billion a year, every year, on improper payments. We send checks to people who are not entitled to receive them for the earned income tax credit, for example. We spend money on people who don't exist or aren't qualified to receive Medicaid. We even send money to dead people.
All right.
And all of what he says is true. And there's no way to avoid sending money to dead people. My friend Albert's mother-in-law passed away last weekend, and she got paid her Social Security benefit, but she did not live long enough to be entitled to it for that month, so she was paid, and that money will be owed back to the Social Security Administration. These stimulus payments that were forced out quickly because of the dire economic circumstances, in fact, if we wanted to, we could play what I said, but we were in a economic calamity earlier in 2020 when these packages were put together, and they needed to get money into people's pockets who were not being allowed to work by governmental decrees. And I said, it's just inevitable that they'll pay people they're dead because they're using 2019 and 2018 tax return information. And believe it or not, people die daily in this country.
Huh? What? No. Stop it.
So we've paid, I'm sure, hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars of stimulus payments to people who were deceased at the time the payments were made. And the government will attempt to try to recover those. But the point I made in pre-show is that this is a part of a compassionate society when we pay people. When you're receiving Social Security benefits, sometimes you get caught up on the other side of that. Social Security will receive a report that you're dead. And it'll be a transpositional error in the Social Security number. And a key put error will cause a person to be declared dead, and it's not the right person. And when that happens, and they dutifully terminate your payment, and you contact them and say, hey, I'm alive, they say, nope, you're dead. Now, if you're living Social Security check to Social Security check, you probably would not be amused by that at all. So we built a lot of these programs with the intent of honesty and integrity. And we know that when people are receiving money, whether they be business people that are receiving lucrative government contracts or whether they be individuals that are receiving public assistance, we know that people won't always tell the truth. We know that. But some of the rules are based on retrospective budgeting. And some of the rules are based on prospective budgeting in terms of what you anticipate your income will be. If it turns out that you, in good faith, projected wrong, you may have an overpayment and vice versa, retrospective budgeting. When you do retrospective budgeting, it makes it harder to get paid because you go to the food stamp office and be totally broke and you don't care so much about retrospective budgeting. You want food stamp relief, right? You need something to eat. And then they ask you, we need to do a prospective budget. You're not amused by any of that stuff because you're in dire straits. So we try to build a human compassion into these programs. And you end up, as you do with anything that deals with human nature, there will be people who will exploit that. But I got news for you, Senator Kennedy. Our federal budget deficit is so large that if I took your number of $144 billion at face value, now we cannot assume that all those payments were erroneously made. That's the amount of overpayments that were made. That would not come close to closing the deficit gap. Not even close. The last fiscal year, we ran $2.1 trillion. The previous fiscal year before COVID-19, we ran $984 billion. So I got news for you. And the first part of that clip, he was talking about that Biden wants to raise taxes, wants to raise the gas tax. And he says, well, in fact, he wants to raise all taxes. Well, he hasn't said that. But we do need to find revenue, folks, because the budget is way out of balance.
Tell me, do you think, though, tell me if you think that had they gone too small on kicking out payments, there would have been similar criticism later in the game of how much people are suffering. I don't know that there would have been a way to do this like too little, too much, just right. Like, what is it, the Three Bears? I forget the story.
Well, we won't know until we unpack this in the future. We're seeing some early indications of some inflation pressures, and it may be that there was an overstimulation. We'll have to unpack this and evaluate how much stimulus was done and whether it was too much or too little. We were able to unpack after the 2008-2009 recession that the anemic growth that the Republicans complained so much about was because of very little stimulus. They didn't want to do any stimulus, and they called the $784 billion stimulus, they referred to that as the porculus. And that did keep a lot of government employees that locally and state employed that would have had to been let go, public safety, vital people. The states were hemorrhaging money and didn't have money to pay their employees. A lot of that $784 billion went to keeping people working and vital teachers, you name it, firefighters and so forth. But we won't know if the right amount of stimulus was done, but we are seeing there's shortages of key materials and raw materials. There's price pressures, and we may have some significant inflation. We may realize we overstimulated, but you're right. If we didn't do enough, they would be looking back like we did at 2008-2009, the Great Recession. We didn't do enough, according to the experts who've unpacked that, looking back with more than a decade of time.
Larry, we are at 101. And I don't know, do you want to cover any one of these couple articles, or do we just want to jump ship?
Let's just carry them over to next week, and let's get out of here because we've got some patrons to recognize, don't we?
We do. We just have one new one, and it is a Peter. Hello, Peter. And let me just mention this. I just recently converted Patreon over to where you could do annual memberships, and he is the first one, and I can't thank him enough. It was at a very generous level, and I appreciate it so very, very much, as does Larry. And we are getting closer to that 100 goal where I will do some crazy sax solo for you people.
I'm looking forward to that. And then we have, we're getting more and more mail from the prison audience, and we've got one that I intended to take up this week, but it's just too long, from the Orange County Jail in New York. Believe it or not, New York apparently has an Orange County, but we're going to do LaShawn's question next week.
Excellent. Perfect. Well, with that, Larry, I will bid everyone in chat adieu. There was great conversations going on there. How you get there is become a patron, and then you can join the live stream chat and watch us record this whole thing live. And Larry, I appreciate you providing all the information. And Dee, thank you for coming on. And I hope everybody has a great rest of the weekend. And I will talk to everybody soon. Thanks, Larry.
Thanks for having me.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.